Hello there, and you're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is Kaveri Madhavan. She's the author of Paddy Indian, The Uncoupling, The Tainted, and her latest novel, The Inheritance, is out now. I started by asking Kaveri what life was like for her growing up. Kaveri, what I normally do with guests is bring them back right to the beginning. And I'm really intrigued because I know so very little about you. I've done a little bit of research, but I don't really know that much about you. So I'd love to know about what it was like growing up for you and where you grew up and like what kind of a house, was it a bookish house? And just that sort of thing. What were your very early days like? And perhaps there's a book from that time as well that you'd like to see of in particular.
I had a really idyllic, happy childhood. My father was in the army and we moved around a good bit. But I think part of it being an idyllic childhood was that both my parents are huge, big readers. And every time my father's regiment got posted somewhere, if we had 50 boxes, 50 crates, you know, 25 would be just books. So I grew up in a very much a reading household. Of course, there was no television at that time, you know, so it was either the radio or you read. And one of my abiding memories as a child, and literally it's one of my earliest memories, was, you know, every weekend we'd go down to the secondhand book markets, of which India has like tons of them, and they're very popular in India. And we'd, my brother and myself, we'd get a rupee each, and we'd just be let loose, you know, to buy whatever we fancied. We were never told you can't have that or you can't have that, you know, and a rupee would get you, oh my God, at least 10 books or a combination of books and comics or whatever. So, and then we'd come home, and then the whole week long would be just, you know, in the evenings we'd either be read to. I actually can't remember being read to, which is a bit of an odd thing, but I obviously was, you know, I must have been read to. But, you know, we spent a lot of time reading, my brother and myself.
And do you remember learning to read? You say you don't remember being read to, but do you remember learning to read yourself, or is that quite dim as well?
No, that's also a very dim memory. And I'm actually quite shocked that I can't remember.
Maybe you learned very early. You know, sometimes if you have extremely early experiences and you don't remember them in the same way.
Yeah, Indian schools, children start school at 3.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, and I, you'll be shocked now at this. I actually started school when I was 2.5.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, it sounds nutty, you know, it sounds absolutely nutty, but I actually went to a kindergarten school at 2.5. And when I left high school, I was the youngest person in the state at that time. I studied in Bombay. I was the youngest person to have sat the school leaving exam. And the year after I sat it, the rules changed, and a lot of it had to do with me being only 13 and a half.
Oh my goodness.
It's crazy, you know.
Oh my goodness, you were 13 and a half when you did the equivalent to our leaving cert or A levels, or
it would actually be 10th class. It's neither the junior nor the leaving. It would be like, say, maybe being in fifth class.
Gosh.
Yeah, the state government had to give me a special dispensation to sit the exam, because the school said, well, look, you know, we enrolled her, so she's in it now. And, you know, so I can't even remember the details anyway. But I finished school in 1975 and I was born in 1962.
That's incredible.
And it wasn't a good thing, because my parents always fretted about it, you know. They felt that all my peers in my class were much older and they had, you know, different interests. Like when my classmates were getting their periods for the first time, didn't even know what a period was, you know. And then even when I went to pre-university, so I attended pre-university in university. It was a transitional stage in the Indian education system. You know, they were transitioning from doing your school leaving in 10th class to moving it to 12th, as is normal everywhere else in the world. So our batch did 2 years of pre-university, but we did it in university. So like when I went to do my pre-university in a university college, you know, I was very young and my parents were quite anxious I might get into bad company because of peer pressure.
Yeah, understandably. Like you were what, 13 and a half, 14 when you went into this kind of...
Yeah. So I graduated when I was 19.
You graduated university at 19.
Yeah. So it's nuts, absolutely nuts. I mean, I'd never subject a child to that again. Now, having said that, I had very happy memories, you know.
But did you feel always that you were slightly out of joint with everything, that you were always sort of, no?
No, No, I didn't. And all of this that I'm telling you is from later on when I was married and everything. My parents saying, "Oh, we used to worry so much about you."
But you weren't aware at the time of any kind of.
Yeah, no, at that time I wasn't aware of it at all, you know.
That's such an interesting story. And so did that affect then the kinds of things that you were reading? Were you reading ahead of perhaps what you would have been?
Absolutely, absolutely, 100%. I was reading way ahead, you know, and of course I had access to the books. So definitely was reading way ahead because, you know, my parents had such an amazing library.
Of course, yeah. So by the time you were 14, 15, you were reading
Yeah.
pre-university texts and things.
Yeah, it's a bit bad.
Goodness.
No regrets, you know, no regrets at all. Yeah, and I came from a strange, well, not very strange in India, but would be quite strange for this part of the world. But my parents did not share a common language. My father was Tamil, and my mother, her language is a dialect called Coorg. So they spoke to each other only in English. As a result of which, you know, I grew up in an English-speaking home. My mother tongue would be English, you know.
So yes, I was going to ask you that earlier about what language you were reading, and so you were reading in English.
Yeah, and so would both my parents have been reading in English, you know.
So English was their love language in a way.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, in those days, there wasn't much of publishing in regional languages.
Okay.
I mean, there would have been obviously regional language newspapers and magazines, but not many books. I've never asked my parents, I never asked my father when he was alive or my mother recently, why they never read in their own languages.
I'm sorry, I'm going a bit off tangent here, but did they have a kind of complicated relationship with the English language because of, I suppose, where it comes from? Or was it divorced from?
No, completely divorced. And I mean, you know, because the Indian Army would have run on English. You know, and then of course, depending on which part of the country the regiment was posted, you know, the languages would just be picked up. My mother would be multilingual from having lived in so many parts of India.
Look at it, you had all sorts of things going on there, like with language and also with the kind of precocious timing of your, and I mean that in a, just the basic sense, precocious, like earlier than intended, you know, of your education and everything.
True.
Plus, then you were moving around an awful lot that the.
Yeah. And actually, it was because of the moving around that I ended up doing my school leaving so early. Because in India, some schools were January to January, and some schools would have been July to July. Say we moved in July, the normal thing would be my parents would stick me into the first school that they could get me into. And that might have been a January to January school. So I'd only be in a class for 6 months. And then I'd be in the next class.
Moving around for some children could be quite traumatic, just even emotionally, you know, connecting with your classmates and your new
Yeah.
environment, all of that. And you did that multiple times. Did that have a big impact on you?
It didn't have an impact on me, at least I don't think it did, but I have no school friends.
Oh.
The only school friends I have would be the very last school that I was in, and that was in Bombay. And even then, that was just 4 years. And that makes a difference if your schoolmates have been mates for, you know, your entire school years. You then do have a link. Like I literally have only about two or three school friends who I'm in touch with. And yeah, I suppose, you know, there's a small regret in that. But then I have very good friends from university, so they kind of made up for it.
I suppose there's lots of advantages to that too, in how you can be sort of elastic in your
Yeah.
kind of connections and stuff like that. Would you have a book from like your very early reading, like before you were a teenager, stroke going to university, from that very early period in your life that you would choose or that you could tell us about?
I'd love to tell you about, I mean, and this book has stayed with me. It's actually literally the only title that stayed with me. You know, like I could tell you a lot about the kinds of books I read when I was a child before my teen years, but this is the only book whose title and the cover and the story I actually remember. And it's a book called Maya of Mohenjo-Daro and written by a very famous Indian writer called Mulk Raj Anand. He mainly primarily wrote adult fiction, and he would have been really well known, well respected, and much loved Indian writer. He died in 2004, I think. His adult books were my parents' favorites, you know. But this book for children, it actually tells a story of a little girl called Maya who lived 4,000 years ago in the Indus Valley civilization, you know, that part. And I think what's now probably part of northwest Pakistan now, the Mohenjo-Daro and the Harappan civilization. It's a very playful book. It's about this little girl. It's a day in her life, how she wakes up and she wants, you know, she doesn't want to drink her milk, and you know how her mother convinces her that she needs to drink it. Her father's a potter. Her father promises her that he would make her a cup with a handle. It's a really interesting book, and it brought in so many bits of history. I don't think I realized it then. I mean, obviously, I didn't realize it then. Now I really appreciate how he brought in so many historical details into a book for a child. You know, even when I was looking it up just to be able to talk to you about it, I just thought, my God, like I was reading historical fiction from when I was a child, because that's what this book is. It's a picture book with a little bit of text on each page.
It looks beautiful, and I would urge our listeners to look it up as well, because I did. I had never heard of it, again, in my ignorance. But the cover was just, it was beautiful. And yeah, like you say, just that's a whole other, I just feel like there's a whole other door into things here with the books that you've chosen, which I love. And like originally when I was thinking of asking about college or university, I had a very different image of what college and university would have been for you. But obviously it was very different to what I had in mind, the kind of traditional path. But do you mind if I ask you what you studied or what your course was in university and about your reading experience there?
Yeah, sure. My education in school, Ruth, wouldn't have been too different from most Irish people, because I studied with Irish nuns in every single school that I went to.
You studied with Irish nuns. This just gets better and better.
Yeah. So it's a bit nutty. Like I never in my life dreamt I'd come to Ireland, you know, or rather sort of make my life in Ireland. I came to Ireland as a very young woman. You know, I was only 23 when I came.
Gosh.
So my entire schooling was with Irish nuns. Every town and city that my parents moved to, they always picked a convent school, and they were always, by some coincidence, Irish nuns. Coming back to what you were saying about what I studied in university, my university college was also run by nuns, would you believe it? And I went to the Stella Maris College in the Madras University, and I studied economics.
You studied economics, okay. So not a literary path to begin with.
No, not at all. But I loved my teachers, and I had some amazing teachers in school and in college who I still remember. Some of them might be gone by now, but, you know, I remember them really well, and I remember how inspiring they were, you know.
Did you sort of start off on a particular path with economics, or was it the subject itself that kind of grabbed you?
Well, I had this notion that I wanted to join the World Bank. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, as a young teenager, you have notions, and this is something that I really fancied, you know, that I was going to go and work in the UN and all kinds of, you know, dreams like that. But when I was 15 years old, I met my husband.
Oh.
And when I finished university, I did a master's as well. But when I finished my master's, I did my master's in international economics. And at the end of that, after finishing my master's, I then had to decide whether I was going to go on to do a PhD in the US. I had got admission into a university there, whether I was going to do that or whether I was going to stay around with my childhood sweetheart. And I chose him. So.
Yeah, that's so romantic.
Sweet, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah, so that put an end to my UN aspirations, you know. It was just a childish thing, a childish dream, I suppose. You know, I married him shortly after when I was 23, and then came to Ireland immediately after that.
Awesome.
And then just sort of spent a good few years, I'd say nearly 15, 20 years, just reading and reading and reading, and then finally decided to write myself.
Let me just try to get into your shoes there when you arrived in Ireland, and just on your reading journey as well at that point. Like, what was there a change in what you read when you came to Ireland? Obviously, of course, there was going to be like seismic changes in other ways, but like just from a reading point of view, was there any change of direction or deepening of anything, or was there a book from that time that you can remember?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, started reading a lot of Irish writers. I loved Somerset Maugham. He was my father's favorite writer, and I read him a lot in my late teens and early 20s. And then when I came to Ireland, I discovered William Trevor, and, you know, just went down that route, and then John McGahan, and I read a lot of Irish writers, you know, and loved it.
I want to ask you a little bit about this. I mean, again, I'm hugely ignorant on this area, so forgive me if I say anything just terribly gauche or politically wrong. But you have a couple of books here that I looked up because I hadn't heard of. And obviously it's something that runs through, and it runs through some of your novels as well. You know, post-colonialism and kind of the, well, I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm going to ask you about it, really, to tell me why some of these books are so important to you. And I'm thinking in particular of The Sea of Poppies.
I tell you, Ruth, I think my reading habits and my writing as well is really coloured by a complete, how would I put it, annoyance, I suppose would be the word, you know, or kind of annoyance bordering on disgust that, you know, our Indian curriculum remained when I was in school and in university, remained very much what was left behind by the colonial power. So we only learned about what they supposedly gave us, just that whole mantra about, the railways and the court system and this and that. We were taught about reforms. Every viceroy had a list of reforms that we had to learn, how they benefited all of India, but we were never taught about how they looted the country. So I guess a lot of my reading and then my writing would have been influenced by the fact that, it was literally a backlash against what I wasn't taught, and I kind of just went mad reading. And would you believe it? A lot of it I got from reading good fiction, well-researched fiction, rather than actual history books,
Yeah, I can imagine that. And it is shocking. And so that you came to this kind of later on in life, I mean, post university and school, that you came to these books then. So was it a kind of a sort of retrospective anger?
Yeah, retrospective anger. Gosh, you absolutely nailed it. I'm going to use that now in future. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, well, sorry, I shouldn't call myself young. I'm 62. A lot of Indians of my age bristle, when we look back at what we were taught versus the reality. The whole notion that, we should have been eternally grateful to the Brits for what they did, when actually it's exactly the opposite,
And so there's a book, or it's a non-fiction book, or is it fiction? The Inglorious Empire. That's a
Yeah, that actually is a book of nonfiction, and it really lays out very, very clearly, and it puts paid to any kind of nostalgia, false nostalgia, misinformed nostalgia about the British Empire. That what happened to India was not what happened in the far pavilions. I mean, we're so colored by that series, we forget that that wasn't real life. That was just from the British point of view. When you think, Ruth, that 8 million people died in the Bengal famine, multiple times of how many died in Ireland, and we were never I was never taught that. I left India not knowing that, and I'm so ashamed. And at the same time, I don't blame myself,
No,
because that's
not
what
at
I was
all.
taught. Yeah, that, rather, that's what I was not taught. And that was just one famine. There were several of the many, sort of scores of other famines over the 300 years that they ruled us.
Did you find then, speaking out to Irish writers or exploring that concept, that there were some parallels? I'm not equating the two in any sense, but just in that sense of what you're shown, what you're taught, or what you're led to believe by the kinds of predominant narrative, there are a few similarities with.
There are similarities, Ruth. The only difference is that Indians of my age didn't know. We weren't taught. Okay. In Ireland, we were taught. Everybody in Ireland, every school child in Ireland knows what was done. But just like how Indians have remained for a long, long time unaware of what really happened, British children have not been taught what they did to Ireland. There is a similarity. It's just that there's a difference in who knew what. So, children in the UK, children in India weren't taught. So, I mean, there are 62-year-olds like myself in the UK, English people who have no notion of what their country did to other
No
countries.
idea. It's
I think,
incredible, isn't it?
yeah, that's the one reason why the Irish story is known worldwide, because Ireland knew and Ireland taught their children. In India, we weren't taught, and in the UK, they weren't taught.
It's interesting, isn't it? Who holds the narrative, or who drives the narrative? Tell us a little bit about this trilogy then. It's by, am I pronouncing this,
Amitav
Amitav
Ghosh.
Ghosh.
Yeah. The Sea of Poppies, I remember even before I read The Sea of Poppies, wondering, why on earth are there so many Indians in strange places like Fiji or in the West Indies? And what the hell were Indians doing in South Africa? How did they even end up there? When you read the trilogy, you realize how the Brits tricked Indians, poor, very, very poor subsistence farmers, converting their meager half an acre, 1 acre that they were growing growing and eating themselves, converting them into growing poppy. Because the English were fighting the Opium Wars, and they needed poppy, and they what they did in Bengal, they said, oh, if you grow opium instead, if you grow poppies, you'll get much more and this and that and the other, and then they loaned them money to change the crop, and these poor farmers, right, they're dirt poor farmers, they were never able
Get back.
to repay those, and then they were told, okay, there's a very easy way for you to repay it. You know, you can go off as indentured
Oh,
laborers. And sure, they never came
no.
back.
Just a way, another way of no.
Weren't they ever able to repay their debts? And the British just took over their lands, and they did this systematically. You know, they lent money at exorbitant rates for two people to grow opium, and then they were never able to repay it. Off you go on a boat off to, you know, wherever the Brits had, you know, sugar plantations or whatever, you know, cotton, whatever, wherever they were sort of wherever they needed labor, cheap labor, and they sent them off. And you know, there were people who left. They were uneducated. They didn't even know the names of their own villages sometimes.
Oh,
Do you know? So they were never able to come back.
that's heartbreaking.
When they arrived, say when they arrived in Fiji or when they arrived in the West Indies, they would just ask their name, you know, and like some of them just only had the name. They weren't able to furnish the name of a village or where they came from. So they literally had no roots to even look back and go back. And this book, when I read it, you know, when it first came out, I was just so overwhelmed by the history in that. You know, it is just so such a cruel thing that they did, and they've never acknowledged it properly. You know, it's all just piecemeal, you
That's
know.
another question, isn't it, for another day, about acknowledging and apologizing and all the rest of
Yeah,
it.
if you look at Ireland, you know, in Ireland, it's a completely different thing. You know, every one of those people who was transported, you know, their stories have been told. You know, people who were sent off to Australia, you know, the orphan girls who went to be wives to Australia or wherever Irish people went, it was recorded. The Irish state, the Irish people took responsibility to keep those stories alive. And India and Indians are coming late to it.
Okay, yeah.
And often from no fault of their own, it's just that they were just not taught.
No, and some of these stories just truncated or dissipated because there was no way to find the way back. Well, just to remind everybody, that's the Sea of Poppies trilogy, if you want to look that up. I'm going to move on to your life in Ireland. So you came over with your childhood sweetheart, which is a whole book in itself, that you knew since you were 15, and chose him over the World Bank or whatever, or the States, or
I'll have to
yeah,
say it
just
that
you know, she could have been in the UN by now.
way.
Where did you first live when you
We first lived in Sligo.
in
We came
Sligo?
straight from India to Sligo.
Okay, so Yeats territory and Ryder territory and
Exactly, yeah.
whole lot. Is there a book from these years, I suppose your early years and into motherhood, that you kind of maybe go back to or you return to, or just maybe a book from that time that maybe offered you comfort or kind of kept you going, you know, through life's kind of.
I left a year after my brother had died. My brother died. He was only 19 years old, and we were only two of us. We were just, you know, the two of us, and so I lost my only
Oh.
sibling, and so it was a very sad time when I came to Ireland. It was quite a sad time. I read a lot of Khalil Gibran's writing, and I turned to the Prophet a lot. I actually just loved his philosophy. I loved his. I found every one of his poems very calming, especially when I had my own children. I would sort of dip in and out of the Prophet and really, you know, really benefit from it.
It's nourishment.
Yeah, I've saved a thing that I returned to time and time again, you know, his poem on children.
Oh, good.
And I'll just read it out quickly, just as a edited version of it. One line in his poem is, "Your children are not your children." And then he goes on to say, "You may give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams." There's a last line: "You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday." We've really tried very hard to bring up our children with that in mind, you know, let them be their own people.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. It's kind of devastating.
Oh,
Oh, no, it's lovely. Yeah. House of Tomorrow.
one of my daughters is now married, you know, and very often, you know, it's at the tip of your tongue to say, or do this or do that. And then you think, no, Jesus, it's their own house. Let them do if they want to, if they want to have pink wallpaper or they want to have black
Let it
tiles.
go. Yeah.
That's all kind of very sort of mundane stuff. But you just
I
have
know
to
what you
let
mean.
them go and do their own thing, you know.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Oh, that's beautiful. Okay, so I'm going to ask you about something more lighthearted now, Anna, because I saw your answer. I saw your discussion. I saw your answer to this, and I was like, oh God, yeah, I used to read Peanuts all the time when I was still, or it was just lying around the
That's
house. And
right.
this is something that kind of gives you a bit of a giggle or uplifts you.
Absolutely. I was reading Peanuts from when I was very young. I'd say maybe 13, 14, and then continue to read it. Like even now, I have one book that my husband gave me when I think for my 17th birthday that I still have.
Oh,
And even you get something completely different when you look at it as an adult. I think it's very
awesome.
much like Simpsons, like The Simpsons, get something out of it as a child and something out of it as an adult. And I think for me, Linus and Lucy, I always thought Linus and Lucy was me and my brother.
Oh.
I was a bit of a bossy boots to my brother. It's so sad because we had the very normal, brother and sister sibling relationship. We fought like cat and dog. And then, when I turned about maybe 17 or 18, and he was, about 15 at that time, there was 3 years in the difference between us. We'd kind of outgrown it and we'd just started to become very, very good friends. So, the Linus Lucy thing really kind of, it reminds me even now when I read, like how she bossed him about a bit and,
Oh yeah, Lucy was great. We had like big hardback annuals of the Peanuts.
Yes, that's right. We'd get them in the secondhand bookshops, because I think at that time, I'm almost certain at that time they weren't being published in India. They were being imported. The secondhand imports would come to
Yes,
the street bookshops. That's how we'd get them,
I'm just remembering Snoopy on his kennel. He always pretending to be a different character, or like his writing as
Yeah,
well.
that's right.
It'd be like
I think I
fantastic.
loved, because I always had a fancy for reading, I loved the fact that this little dog sat on his kennel and typed away,
Yeah, it was a dark and stormy night. Yeah. Kaviri, I'm going to ask you now if there's a book that you would leave in the burning house, in our hypothetical burning house, to burn. And if so,
Oh my
what would
God,
it
Ruth, every single bloody diet book, is
be?
what I would leave behind. I mean, I've not bought a million diet books. No, I haven't. But the one or two I bought over the years, I would dump them instantly. I wouldn't wait. I wouldn't wait for the house to be burning. I'd just put them in the fire straight away,
Yeah, life is too
Life
short
is too
for
short.
life.
And I
Absolutely.
mean, all of them are such extremes when actually, the best, the healthiest way is to just, eat in moderation and eat everything. So
Yeah, a little bit of what you fancy does you good is is a good motto. And I suppose then, if there's something from the house that isn't a book or an animal, that you would save, a non-book item, what would that be, Kaviri?
Oh God, Ruth. I hope I can hold myself together for this one. Do you know my when my brother died, he my brother was actually a really oh God. He's exactly the kind of person people say, he the best are taken young. And he was very handsome, very, very intelligent. And he was a fantastic sportsman. So he was an all-rounder. He was really he was an A student. He played sport at a very high level. And he won a rowing gold, a gold medal at the National Rowing Championships, a gold medal. And that medal actually was put on his body when he was cremated. And when we went to collect his ashes, it was actually nearly intact. It was only melted a little bit. And I just kept it. I didn't even tell my parents. I didn't say to anybody. I just kept it all these years. And yeah, that's what I'd save.
Thank you, Kaviri. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Sorry,
And thanks. That's okay. We'll take a break there. And thanks so much for talking with me today. It's been an
Yeah,
absolute
thanks, Ruth.
pleasure to meet
Me
you.
too.
And I could have talked for another hour, but I'm going to ask you now to finish with a reading from your new book. It's called The Inheritance, and it's out very soon. I think by the time this is broadcast, it'll be out imminently. So maybe you could start by telling our listeners just a little bit about the inheritance and then just finish off with a reading for
Okay.
us.
So Ruth, my new book, The Inheritance, is based in Glengariff in West Cork, and it's set in 1986. It's about a young man of a London Irish heritage who comes back. You know, he inherits a house and he comes back. He inherits a cottage, returns from London to Glengariff at a time when all the young men of Ireland are leaving Ireland. And it's what happens to him after he arrives. But there's also a historical thread from 400 years ago running through the book. It's the story of O'Sullivan Bearer, you know, his hiding away in the forest with his kinspeople for over 6 months before he had to do that long march from Bearer to Leitrim in 1602. That's kind of a short, potted history of my book. I'm actually reading the opening chapter and the opening page. Glengariff, Ireland, April 1986. It all began the day he found out that his sister was his mother. As the minibus hiccuped its way up the steep, rutted road, Marlowe repeated that to himself. This journey started when I found out that Mary was my mam, and mam was my nana. The revelation had made his head spin for a good few days. In fact, his whole life was still spinning out of control, nearly. Maybe things would be better now that he was finally in Ireland. At least that's what everyone had said repeatedly. It had taken him several weeks before he agreed that heading to the Bearer Peninsula, to the old cottage in Glengariff, might be a move in the right direction. Perhaps. It's a chance to start afresh, son. Don't feckin' call me that, Mary. You'll never be my man. She had teared up. Ah, oh, Christ, don't be like that, Marlowe. It is what it is, for God's sake. He looked at his sister and his mother, facing him across the table in their new avatars, as his mother and his grandmother. You keep telling me no one in Glengariff knows, but are you sure? They both nodded. No one, not in Ireland, not even here in London. Mam reached out and took his hand in hers, squeezing it as hard as Mary continued. Any other way, and we'd have lost you. I'd have lost you. Mam wiped her eyes. Yes, Mary would have lost you. Do you even understand? 4 months later at the airport, Mary had pressed a medallion into his palm and hugged him. Write every week and ring us when you can. Mam said there used to be a phone box by the Garda station in the village. Ring me at the surgery. I know Dr. Khan won't mind. I'll ring Mam when I can. Mrs. Kelly won't mind giving her a shout across the landing. Okay, said Mary, but call me too. Now, as he peered into the darkness outside the bus, he ran his finger around the smooth oval edge of the holy medal in his coat pocket. Saint Jude. What the feck, Mary? I'm not a fecking lost cause.
You've been listening to the wonderful Kaveri Madhavan, whose latest book, The Inheritance, is out now with Hope Road Publishing. See you all next time.